Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
And we start in Syria. Today, the Syrian government says it's opened a new corridor for rebels and civilians to flee the city of Aleppo. But the UN says it's concerned they won't have safe passage. This is all part of the supposed pause in fighting announced by Russia, which is backing the Syrian government. But at the same time, Russian warships are on their way to Syria, a huge Russian aircraft carrier traveling through the English Channel today under the watchful eye of the British military. The BBC's James Longman is following all of this from Beirut. James, we spoke to reporter Elizabeth Palmer in Aleppo a few days ago, and she said many who were trapped in the eastern part of the city would never leave because they feared once they did, they'd be killed by government forces. So what are you hearing?
Well, I think that, to want to go over to the government side, which is, I think, how this is being understood in East Aleppo, requires a level of trust which doesn't really exist anywhere in Syria, let alone in East Aleppo. This is a place which has been under siege for coming on 2 years, has had no aid since mid-July, and as we know, has been facing these bombardments pretty relentlessly for the last few weeks. The choice, as we understand it from the United Nations, is that those who seek to leave, either because they're sick or wounded, or because they just want to be able to get out, can go to one of two places. They can either go over to West Aleppo, which is run by the government, or they're given the choice to go up to Idlib, which is still in opposition hands. So people there can go over to another part of Syria, which is still not controlled by the government. And so that particular fear about being killed by the government could be allayed. But the issue there is that bombardments continue on those other parts of Syria. So if you like, it's out of the frying pan and into the pan. I mean, it is an extraordinarily difficult situation for people in East Aleppo. And we are hearing perhaps there's some suggestion that they're being impeded from leaving by rebels who are concerned that as soon as they get the green light to leave, people will go and then the bombardments will start again so that no aid can come into East Aleppo. So we spoke to the United Nations earlier today and they said the situation was just way too fluid to be able to allow these evacuations to take place.
Oh, so are you saying that while we're hearing that there were to be evacuations and a corridor for people in eastern Aleppo, there's really not?
No, the United Nations told us today that that is not happening today.
Yeah.
They are going to have to wait and see if that is going to happen tomorrow. It's starting to get to nightfall now. The United Nations has said that they look at this on an hour-by-hour basis, but it's important to remember that the humanitarian pause is only in place for 11 hours during the day. The bombings from the air do continue overnight, so there's no way that that the evacuations could take place overnight. It wouldn't be safe enough anyway. So the effort to evacuate people will begin again tomorrow. The Russians have extended their ceasefire until tomorrow, 7 p.m. local time. But it should be noted, you know, the Russians, when they set this humanitarian pause up and they said they were going to be able to facilitate these evacuations, they were very keen to take credit for something that the U.S. hasn't been able to do. But it seems that they're coming up against the same issues, which is that because there are so many different groups on the ground in East Aleppo, it's just still not safe enough for the United Nations to operate.
Now, talk about Russia's role. These warships now headed to the Syrian coast. Is there a sense that Russia may be taking advantage of the Obama administration's decision not to be more aggressive in Syria, thinking that perhaps a Clinton administration, as many people here in the U.S. are thinking, a Clinton administration would be more hawkish?
I think that's a very good reading. The Clinton objective in Syria, she has said it time and time again, is perhaps to institute some kind of no-fly zone. That's something that President Obama hasn't been wanting to do. It's certainly not something a lot of other countries think that they can do, because what does that mean? That means military incursion inside Syria. So perhaps the Russians are thinking, well, yeah, if Hillary Clinton wants to do this, we've got to get in on the ground and make that basically impossible going forward. The problem with that plan, though, is that the Russians have some of the most sophisticated anti-aircraft weaponry you can get. They have S-300s, S-400s sitting in the north, making sure that the skies over northern Syria are totally protected. If American jets so much as try to go over that area area, I think we can probably safely assume that the Russians would want to take those out. And we've got to wait and see what they do, obviously, if and when she wins in January. But, you know, that's something for another day. At the moment, the Russians, as you say, are pushing ahead with consolidating their power in Syria.
I'm glad you underscore that, if she wins, of course. The BBC's James Longman in Beirut. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
According to the Pew Research Center, public support for the death penalty in the U.S. is near a 50-year low. Californians will have a choice on Election Day to either end their state's death penalty or change it. California has the largest number of people on death row in the country. Saul Gonzalez from member station KCRW went to San Quentin Prison, and a warning, his report contains some graphic language.
You get a sense of the sheer number of inmates awaiting execution in California when you visit San Quentin's death row exercise yard at midday, where hundreds of men congregate.
So all of you guys are in death row?
Yeah, death
Everyone
row,
here
brother.
In this huge yard?
Everybody, everybody, everywhere you can see. Death row, sentenced to death.
That's death row inmate Anthony Bankston, who walks over to speak to me. He's on one side of a security fence, I'm on the other.
So what are you in here for, man?
I'm in here for homicide. Two murders.
Two murders,
yes,
where?
Right. Los Angeles County.
When?
1991.
And you guilty? I mean, do you acknowledge
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. I did terrible things, brother. Terrible things. I'm not proud of.
Who did you kill, man?
African-American Crip gang member and a Latin American rival.
There are currently just under 750 men on California's death row, which is actually an entire complex of buildings at San Quentin with different levels of security. More violent inmates are imprisoned in a cell block called the Adjustment Center. When they're let outside for exercise, each Adjustment Center death row inmate is kept in his own steel cage. The kind of looks like what you'd see in an old-time zoo. It's here that I meet Joseph Perez, convicted of murdering a woman during a home invasion robbery.
It's a miserable life in prison, being surrounded in a concrete coffin, surrounded concrete and steel, surrounded about people... by people that you wouldn't communicate with on the street for whatever reason. And then look at this case. I'm in an 8x10 dog kennel. This is a dog kennel. You know what I'm saying? This is a miserable life.
But for all of its misery and bleakness, there's something really important you should know about California's death row. Not a lot of people actually die here. At least not from executions. Since 1978, only 13 people have been put to death on death row, and no one has been executed in over a decade. That's because of legal challenges to California's capital punishment system, disputes over lethal injection, and just how slowly death penalty cases work their way through the courts, especially when they're appealed. Joseph Perez, who's appealing his conviction, knows all about that.
You don't get attorneys for at least 5 years. Then once you get your attorney, then it takes another possible 10 years for your records to be corrected, for your attorneys to file all their motions, all that. And then after that, then it could take another 5, 6, 7 years for them to even hear your arguments.
Perez, who's 45, says he's more afraid of dying of old age at San Quentin than being executed.
If I don't win my appeal, then I don't want to be here 25, 30 years. If my body allows that. If I have to stay in prison, if I got to die in prison, let's get it over with now.
So you'd rather be executed?
Yeah. I don't want to be an old, decrepit man walking a prison yard.
To fix what's widely acknowledged to be a broken capital punishment system in California, there are two competing propositions on the state's November ballot. Passage of Proposition 62 would end the death penalty and replace it with life without the possibility of parole. Supporters of 62 argue capital punishment is both morally wrong and has cost the state billions of dollars for no benefit. But the passage of Proposition 66 would streamline capital punishment in California, putting a cap on petitions challenging death row convictions and a time limit on death penalty reviews. Prop 66 supporters want death row inmates to go to the execution chamber faster to pay for the crimes they've been convicted of committing, saving taxpayers millions of dollars in the process. Like people in the outside world, the hundreds locked up on death row also argue about the utility and morality of California's death penalty. Death row inmate Anthony Bankston says he'll accept whatever the voters decide in November.
Let me ask you this. If it's a choice between being in here for the rest of your life or execution.
Yeah.
What do you choose?
They're both acceptable to me. Right. Because of the heinous things I've done. I've done things that law enforcement don't even know about.
But in his cell block, where he has to speak to me through a solid metal door, inmate Daryl Smith echoes a more common view heard about the death penalty around death row.
The reality is it's arbitrarily applied to poor people, black people, Latino people, or poor people in general. I know this is a cliche type of a complaint that you guys hear from people that's advocating against the death penalty, but it's true.
Meanwhile, California's death row continues to grow as more people get sentenced to death, but no one gets executed. Death row's newest arrivals include a 25-year-old man convicted of a double murder in the city of Oakland and Lonnie Franklin, a notorious L.A. serial killer known as the Grim Sleeper. He was convicted this year of killing 9 women and a teenage girl between 1985 and 2007. For Here and Now, I'm Saul Gonzalez at San Quentin Prison.
Generations of Americans fondly remember the scene from the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz, the part where the good witch, Glinda, tells Dorothy how to use the magic of the ruby slippers.
Then close your eyes and tap your heels together 3 times. And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
After the film, those ruby slippers Dorothy kept tapping went to an MGM warehouse, then to auction, and then were given to the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. Now the famous slippers are in need of repair. The Smithsonian has begun a Kickstarter campaign to raise $300,000 to conserve the slippers and build a new showcase for them. Don Wallace is objects conservator at the National Museum of American History. And Don, what are the ruby slippers made of?
The ruby slippers are actually made of a commercially bought pair of pumps that would have been found in Los Angeles at the time. What they would have done is the studio would have had them dyed red, and then the sequins would have been hand-stitched onto a netting that would then be attached to the top of the slippers, giving them that sequin ruby glow. The beads were also hand-stitched onto a layered textile to be attached to the shoe.
So were they pretty sturdy?
Yes, these shoes would have been used for dancing. They would have been your everyday comfortable shoes.
So the Smithsonian has had the ruby slippers, and actually it sounds like they're more like shoes, but we call them slippers since 1979. What is their condition right now, and what's it going to take to restore them?
The condition right now is well-loved and well-worn. These shoes during the filming would have been used for the dance scenes while they were on the yellow brick road and the soundstage. And they are almost 80 years old, so they are definitely beginning to show their age.
How so?
The top of the shoes have light damage. We can see that there is fading to the sequins that are exposed. This also causes issue with the sequins themselves are made of a cellulose nitrate coating over a gelatin. And that coating is very sensitive to the light.
So now that they have been residing at the Smithsonian, how was the decision made to raise money on this Kickstarter campaign, $300,000, to try and get them conserved?
Well, last year in 2015, the National Air and Space Museum had a very successful Kickstarter campaign to conserve and display Neil Armstrong's suit. And it was such a success and such a positive experience bringing in the public that we had hoped that we could do the same thing for the ruby slippers at the American History Museum.
Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon. And so that was successful. There are lots of pieces of Americana at the Smithsonian Museums, though. Where do the ruby slippers stand compared to the others?
I would say the ruby slippers are one of the most beloved treasures of the American history. They are probably second only to the Star-Spangled Banner that is currently on display at the museum right now.
How are you going to conserve them? What will be done?
The conservation is going to be a really large project. Besides just treatment, we will need to remove any dust and dirt in the recesses, which will take sequin by sequin and bead by bead. But we also need to do extensive research. The ruby slippers are made of over 12 different materials. Through the scientific research, we can figure out the best environment, including humidity and temperature and various light levels that we need. From that information, we are going to then make a state-of-the-art special display case. And this display case is really going to serve as the long-term care for the ruby slippers.
Almost like you're dealing with a piece of art.
Absolutely. The ruby slippers are a piece of art. They are beloved and they're treasured and they are treated as such.
If they're so valuable, why doesn't the government, which runs the museums, put up the money for them to be conserved?
Well, the Smithsonian does get generous federal funding every year, but it really only covers a portion to keep the buildings run and pay for staff. Many of the projects and exhibits that are put on need private funding.
Don Wallace, I want you to tell me one thing about what it's like for you to deal with the ruby slippers, because I guess you probably, like the rest of us, grew up watching Dorothy and everyone else in The Wizard of Oz and admiring the ruby slippers, and now you're up close and personal with them and taking care of them.
I can say that it truly is a dream to work with the ruby slippers. I have watched the movie since I was a young child, and even whenever I hold them in my hands and I get to look at them, you can feel this magic, this real experience around them, and you're constantly smiling whenever you're with them.
Do they fit?
I do not know if they fit, but if
just
only.
Just testing. Well, nice to talk to you. Don Wallace, objects conservator at the National Museum of American History, talking about the Kickstarter campaign to raise enough money to conserve the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. Don, thank you. Good luck.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And staying on the cultural front now, a different kind of classic film, a cult favorite, also a huge TV hit, is about to start a new season. The TV show First. The AMC series about zombies, The Walking Dead, starts up season 7 this weekend. Now, the last season ended in a heartwarming way. A new character named Negan entered the scene and made an unforgettable impression.
You can breathe. You can blink. You can cry. Hell, you're all going to be doing that.
Okay, we can stop it right there. Let's just say that the scene involved a baseball bat and barbed wire. Joining us is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Now, we don't know who was on the receiving end of that encounter, Eric, but we do know it was one of the central characters. How successfully has that scene become for writers to keep fans eager for the new season that begins this weekend to find out just who was offed?
Ooh, I can't wait to find out. You know, for fans of the show and people who've read the graphic novel that the show is based on, this is a crucial moment. The Negan character is a pivotal character from the graphic novel. The worst villain that Rick Grimes and his hardy band of survivors of the zombie apocalypse have faced. And they would not release the new episode to critics. Normally, we get to see the first new episode of the season a week or two before it airs so that we can all write our analysis as TV critics. But they did not release it, probably because they didn't want word to leak.
So here's the question. A lot of people, including you, Eric, are waiting for season 7 to begin. The Walking Dead also got picked up for its 8th season right as season 7 is about to start. What is it about the show, especially for those people listening who may not watch it? Is it the lure of the zombies or the lure of lurid content?
I think it combines a bunch of different things that are really compelling. It's about, you know, the zombie apocalypse. That's a type of a fiction and movie and television work that people are really hooked into. That has a really strong constituency. There's also high quality acting. And there's that secret sauce that no one can quite figure out where the alchemy of all the characters come together and people really respond to it. I mean, on some level, it's hard to say why did people hook into the show the way it did, but it is a new way of telling an old story in a way that talks about some really interesting issues. You know, when does a hero become a villain? What does it mean to be human in an inhuman world? How do you survive when everything that you know, all civilization has kind of been wiped away and you have to start all over again? These are sort of eternal questions that we've seen in a lot of movies and TV shows, but The Walking Dead asks those questions in really compelling and new and different ways.
So The Walking Dead starts up, as we said, season 7 this coming Sunday. Now, Eric, let's make a 180 turn to a bit of singing and dancing and fishnets. Or to put it another way, you want to do the time warp again, Eric?
It's just a jump to the left.
Last night, Fox aired a reboot of the campy Rocky Horror Picture Show, the cult film from 1975, which is a college favorite and still makes an appearance around this time of year. This time around, though, it stars Laverne Cox of Orange is the New Black. She is playing the role of Frankenfurter. That's the role that was famously played by Tim Curry so long ago. He was the sweet transvestite. Let's hear him.
By the light of the night, it'll all seem all right. I'll get you a satanic mechanic.
And here's Laverne Cox's version.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
So here's the question, Eric. Why did Fox decide to do a remake of Rocky Horror now?
Well, there's a bunch of the trends sort of coming together. We have a lot of reboots on television. Everything from Lethal Weapon to The Exorcist has been remade, and Fox in particular has done a lot of reboots. The musical on television is enjoying kind of a renaissance. Now, most of the time we've seen these as live productions, The Sound of Music on NBC, or Grease Live was on Fox. Now, what's interesting about this is this was all sort of pre-taped and done in the way that a musical film might be done, where they recorded all the musical performances separately, and then they record all the visuals and they kind of put it together. And it feels odd in a way. I did wonder why they remade this and why they didn't tweak it more to speak to today's audiences. The opening number of the show, for example, makes references to Fay Wray and Claude Rains and RKO. And I'm just thinking millennials have no idea who these people or companies really are. So in a weird way, it's sort of like they didn't do it as a live musical, so there was not that live energy. And they didn't change it very much. So it's hard to understand why they didn't focus it more to speak to today's mores. You know, we have so many things in society where we're negotiating issues involving transgender people and lesbian and bisexual and gay rights. Why couldn't they refocus Rocky Horror to maybe take on some of that stuff and give us a story for today instead of giving us, you know, a really well-done cover version of a movie that came out 30 years ago?
Good to talk to you. TV critic for NPR, Eric Deggans, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The city of Bakersfield, California, is known for country music, agriculture, oil production, and bird watching, as Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero discovered in a neighborhood park lined with tall palm trees.
Maddie, Elsie, and I walk binoculars in hand through Beale Park in the center of Bakersfield, California. I'd read about a group of parakeets living in the area while researching how to take care of my own pet parakeets. Elsie's a member of the Kern Audubon Society here in town.
There's one. Oh, look. About six of them.
That's so cool. I'm like birding out right now.
Good. Once you get hooked.
I was shocked at how big the parakeets are. The green and yellow birds can grow up to 16 inches long. They're technically small parrots, but what sets them apart are their long tails. These parakeets are native to Asia and some parts of Africa. So why do thousands of them call Bakersfield home? Allison Sheehy is a master naturalist who focuses on this region. She says it all started with bad weather.
In 1977, there was a huge windstorm that hit. The winds were in excess of 100 miles an hour, and it blew apart an aviary.
Two breeding pairs of parakeets escaped.
There were a lot of other birds that escaped, but it seemed like the rosary parakeets were the only ones that successfully started breeding.
Almost 40 years later, these parakeets are thriving in Bakersfield because the temperature and rainfall is similar to northern India, where the original breeding birds are from. Sheehy says there are about 3,000 of them living in palm trees by night. By day, they roam the city hunting for nuts, stone fruit, and flowers to eat. Sheehy doesn't think the parakeets will leave the city because they're afraid of predators.
So that basically they're kept into Bakersfield. They're not migratory. They don't fly out to Fresno or any place else.
Sheehy says the parakeets are doing well in the area. And she says their bills may even be adapting, possibly to take advantage of food sources in the city. She says the population seems to have larger bills than back when they first escaped in 1976.
Whether it's actually genetics from that subspecies or we're seeing an evolutionary adaptation to young who can survive, who have the larger bill. I don't know yet.
Every day at dusk, the parakeets return to their roosts in a tall patch of palm trees on the corner of Union and California Avenues in Bakersfield. Their neighbors are a grocery store across the street. and a group home below the trees. Once the birds settle in for the evening, it's hard to know they're even there. But for birdwatchers who travel miles to see them, these parakeets are a hidden gem. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero in Bakersfield, California.
And while we're on the topic, why not pause for guidance for all of you bird lovers who want to feed the birds in your neighborhood? Backyard birders say our winged friends like to hang out around evergreen trees, so put your feeders there, out of the reach of the family cat. Make sure you have a good place to store your bird feed in a sealed plastic container so you don't attract rodents or those rascally raccoons. And if you need help identifying your feathered friends, there's an app for that. The Audubon Bird Guide North America app is downloadable on your smartphone. You're all set. And now a story not for young ears. After a father in Glasgow, Montana, admitted to repeatedly raping his 12-year-old daughter, a judge sentenced him to essentially just 60 days in jail. And now 75,000 people have signed a Change.org petition to demand the judge be punished. Now, we're not saying the father's name to protect the daughter, but District Judge John McKeon also said he was protecting the victim with his ruling. And he pointed out that state law allows an exception to the mandatory minimum 25-year sentence for incest if the victim is 12 years or younger. Why is that, and what is this law? Montana Assistant Attorney General Dan Gunzinski was appointed to a commission to study the law and is proposing eliminating that exception. Dan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we know that this law is one of many so-called Jessica's laws that came after that terrible story out of Florida. Jessica Lunsford, brutally sexually assaulted and murdered, led to the 2005 law in Florida that requires a mandatory sentence. Tell us more about the law.
Yeah, in 2007, Montana enacted a Jessica Laws provision, which just created harsher penalties for individuals convicted of child sexual abuse, especially when the victim is 12 years of age or under. And what it did, Robin, was created a mandatory minimum of sentence that the judge has to impose in these situations. And the judge shall impose a 100-year sentence with no opportunity for early release or parole for the first 25 years.
Right. Well, and then there's the exception. There's a couple of them, but cite the one that everybody's concerned about now.
Yeah, most of the exceptions are narrowly tailored to accomplish a specific goal. But the one that's been proven to be problematic is 4618.222.6. And what that states is that if a judge determines based on a psychosexual report that residential treatment affords a better opportunity for rehabilitation of the offender and for the ultimate protection of the victim and society, that the judge can depart from Jessica's law and sentence to somebody lesser than what the law calls for. Yeah. And that's what happened in Glasgow.
Well, and Judge McKeon wrote in this rare explanation of what he did that he received letters from the mother and grandmother of the 12-year-old girl saying that it would be far better for the family, especially the sons, they said, if the father was home and the family was intact. And as you say, apparently somebody who did a report on him, an analysis of him, felt it would be better. But it strikes me that one of the problems with this is the unevenness of who's doing that analysis, that psychosexual analysis, because you've seen cases where the opposite decision is made.
Yeah, last year I had a case in Great Falls, Montana, where I prosecuted an individual for raping his daughter. And that person had a favorable evaluation. And the court found, I think rightly so, that the exception didn't apply. There's no basis to ever conclude that in that case that the community was safer with having that child rapist within the community.
And he was sentenced to 25 years without parole.
He was. And I've had lots of cases. I mean, this is really the first time that this exception has been used, to my knowledge, in a Jessica's Law case. I'm not saying it hasn't been in Montana, but I'm not aware of any other case where this exception has been applied to a Jessica's Law case. And the difficulty is that you're right, Robin. You have such disparity in sentencing where one person is going to spend 25 years in prison without parole, and the person in Glasgow is going to get essentially probation.
But how do you recommend fixing this? Shouldn't there be some way that a judge does not have to do the automatic 25 years mandatory?
Well, there are other exceptions we talked about that are narrowly applied to allow for the exception. But the problem with this exception, Robin, is it's so nebulous. This exception talks about that if an evaluator says that somebody can be treated in the community and that the community is safer with that person in the community. And I just don't see when that would really ever occur. I'm not saying it's an impossible burden for a court to establish this exception, but it seems like it would be so rare and even perhaps non-existent, that this exception would ever apply. And so I think there are times when we should have exceptions to mandatory minimums, but I just don't think this is an exception that should go forward because it's not narrowly tailored. It's not well-defined.
Well, we're going to follow this story because obviously many people agree with you, and we'll see what happens there. Montana Assistant Attorney General Dan Kaczynski, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's get to this week's district profile, a district dear to my heart, New York's 3rd Congressional. Shout out to my tribe in Plainview, Olbeth Page. The Democratic incumbent Steve Israel is not seeking re-election, vying for his seat, the Democrat Tom Suozzi and Republican State Senator Jack Martins. Let's bring in reporter John O'Connor of WNYC. So, John, what was the thinking going into the voting about what might happen in this district, and how is it actually shaping up?
This district was on a list, a national list that both parties had come up with, that this would be a competitive race, that it was likely going to be a toss-up, and that with Democrat Steve Israel retiring, Republicans really thought that they had a chance to pick up this seat earlier in the year. As the race has developed, though, that kind of hasn't happened. Polling earlier in October showed the Democratic nominee Tom Suozzi with a big lead, 16 percentage points over the Republican nominee Jack Martins. And so this race looks like it might be slipping away from Republicans a little bit. There's a poll out earlier this week that showed it tightening. That's a Republican poll, though. So it's kind of unclear just how close this race is.
Right. Well, still, there's another signal flag, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and its plan on ad buys.
Yeah, they had booked a bunch of advertising time. They plan to get involved in this race and try and give a boost to Jack Martins. And they've canceled those reservations. So they may not actually buy those ads and get involved in the race as they had originally planned.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at the Democrat, Tom Suozzi, an attorney, a certified public accountant. He was mayor of a large town, Glen Cove, in the 90s until 2001. And he featured John F. Kennedy in a recent ad. Let's listen.
JFK called us to a higher purpose, to do what's right beyond party politics, standing up for the least among us, but always with an eye on the bottom line. Today, that also means protecting clean water in the Long Island Sound, clean energy for energy independence, traditional values for today's challenges. In Congress, I'll be a new kind of old-fashioned Democrat.
What does he mean by that? New kind of old-fashioned Democrat?
Well, the big issues here, I mean, economy, infrastructure, the environment, that's what Suozzi is really pushing. Suozzi is not afraid to say that, hey, I think that government can make a difference, which is not something, you know, we've heard from Republicans typically in the last few years.
Yeah. And let's listen to the Republican. This is, again, the state senator, Jack Martins. Here he is speaking at the Queens Village Republican Club this summer. He spoke about the things he wanted to get done. Here's number one.
Spurring economic activity, rewarding people in their investments and allowing them, if they take the risk and if they open a business and if they're going to sacrifice and make something of it and they're going to hire people and put people to work, they deserve the fruits of their labor, and the government has to take their hands out of our pocket.
And John O'Connor, again from NYC, watching this race, I'm a little surprised that he's lagging as much as he is in this race, because from what I know of this area, it really became a little hardened and conservative after 9/11, after losing so many fire departments and, you know, commuters to that terrible day. It seemed to tilt a little more conservative. What do you think is happening here?
Yeah, and Martins has really made a play on that issue. He's made national security a real centerpiece of his campaign and fighting ISIS and protecting U.S. citizens. He's also touted a bunch of public service firefighters, police union endorsements as well. You know, the big issue that Martins has been fighting this entire race has been name recognition. And there's kind of a weird factor in this race in particular, in that the New York congressional primaries were held back in June. But then there was a lawsuit from another Republican challenger who wanted to get on the ballot, and a court denied him that chance. A court came back later and said, hey, you should have been on the ballot. We're going to hold a primary in October. And then Martins challenged that decision, and another court came back and said, no, we're going to cancel this primary. So for the past 2 months, really, we've been fighting about whether there's going to be another primary, and that hasn't given Martins as much time to get out there and campaign and get his name out there as much as you would expect.
Oh, fascinating. And just briefly, how are the standard bearers affecting this race, if at all, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton?
it's really not clear. Both of these candidates have they haven't run away from the top of the ticket candidates, but they also haven't gone out and fully embraced them either. Martins has said he'll support Donald Trump, and Swazi has been the same way with Hillary Clinton. But you know, they both recognize that those are deeply unpopular candidates. This is a swing district, and so they're trying to win the race or lose the race, as it may be, on their own merits.
John O'Connor of WNYC. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Chicago, 1933, and the world's greatest show, the Century of Progress Exposition, a tremendous panorama of achievements spread before the eyes of thronging multitudes.
One of the things those thronging multitudes came to see at the World's Fair in 1933 was what's called the House of Tomorrow. It still exists today and was declared a national treasure this week by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The designation will help to raise money to restore the House of Tomorrow, which has fallen into disrepair. The house is an example of early modernism. It was full of state-of-the-art appliances and air conditioning even. They were marvels back in 1933. Todd Zeiger is the director of the Indiana Landmarks Northern Regional Office. Todd, could you describe the House of Tomorrow for us?
The House of Tomorrow, designed by Chicago architect George Fred Keck, it was a very forward-thinking and innovative full-glass house with a steel structure, curtain wall, glass walls on the outside. Innovations such as a garage, you could park your car inside and hit a button and the door would go up, and a dishwasher that would wash your dishes for you, and very early into thinking about solar design.
Again, this is back in 1933. Solar design of what way?
Keck designed this house with floor-to-ceiling glass windows and noticed when he was building it in the fair in 33 before it opened that the workmen in Chicago in the winter were in their shirt sleeves, which if you've been in Chicago in the winter is a little novel. And began to realize that that passive solar design could heat a house, and worked with that throughout his career. And that goes all the way back to his work at the House of Tomorrow and the fact that he designed this innovation, this house with a steel structure and curtain walls of glass.
Funny, it still makes it sound like the House of Tomorrow, tomorrow even today in some ways. So the house is now in a state of disrepair, as we said. It's in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, moved from Chicago after the World's Fair closed in 1934. How come it was moved?
It was moved. There was a gentleman by the name of Robert Bartlett, and Bartlett was creating a new development called Beverly Shores, Indiana. And he saw these houses along with another dozen from the fair as a way to begin to promote his development. He would bring folks over from the South Shore and kind of tour them through the houses. So he moved them over there from the fair as a way to spark his development and hope that folks would come buy property in Beverly Shores, what he was promoting as the Miami Beach of the North.
And did they? Was the house a draw?
It was a draw, just like at the fair. I mean, over 39 million people went through the fair itself. And so if you think about the influence that this house, the House of Tomorrow, had, this influence on 39 million people seeing it and these innovations that it had and dreaming about, I don't know, you could park your car inside the house. You know, 1933, you didn't do that. You parked your car in a garage out back like you put the horse.
And by the way, not only was there a garage, attached garage for the house, but also for your own personal airplane, which we would all have.
Yeah, that's everybody loves the airplane hangar. The charge to the designers in the home and industrial arts group of the fair where this house and the other four that are nearby it were at was to design an affordable house that would be thinking about what we would be living at in the future, living in materials and design, appliances, that sort of thing. And the House of Tomorrow very much pushed that envelope the farthest and had the most influence and we would say the most innovation, including, that's right, an airplane hangar. So for some of us, we're still waiting for that innovation and to come, but it had an airplane hangar. You could back your airplane into its own little garage and park it next to your car. Had other things like a machine shop, because if you have an airplane and a car, you need to be able to make some parts and fix it.
Oh, yeah.
And then the living space was actually on the upper floor, what you might call the second floor, which is another innovation of this home. Most people didn't live only on the second floors of their homes. This one elevated that up one story.
What's the status of the house right now in terms of deterioration? Is it stable?
The house is very stable. The steel structure, that innovation of the steel structure is solid. We'll need some repair, but you know that's really the most important piece to make sure you've got a good solid structure, and we've got that. It is a full top-to-bottom restoration. We are figuring about $2 million in cost and maybe 2 years to get it done. It's had some changes, which you would expect after 70 years or so, that will take off. But it's a good place to start, but it is certainly a top-to-bottom restoration.
What's your idea for the house? Ideally, what would you like to see happen with it?
Well, you mentioned this, and actually our vision for this is to make this the best of Keck's design, those influential pieces that we talked about, the glass structure, and but also make this a new house for tomorrow so we can include things around sustainability and the modern technologies that can be put in as part of a rehabilitation. Once the restoration is completed, Indiana Landmarks, who's doing the project, will lease this house completed, so you would be able to live in the house of tomorrow for,
wow,
we're thinking, 3 year periods.
Wow.
And then be able to enjoy that.
Todd Zeiger, director of the Indiana Landmarks Northern Regional Office, preserving the 1933 House of Tomorrow from the Chicago World's Fair. Good luck, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa, very much.
And there is a waiting list, by the way. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.